Welcome back to Trickle Down Socialism, where we discuss how the U.S. currently has a system of socialism for the super rich and corporations, where we try to defang the term socialism and explore how government, with just a slight tweak in priorities and a focus on social investment, could be a force for good in all of our lives.
Welcome back, everyone. See, money is here, but Dan seems to be lost in the woods of New Hampshire right now. I think he's trying to find his way to the Vermont border. But see, money burns. How you doing?
Not too shabby. How are you doing, Pat?
I'm doing pretty well. So on this episode, we have an interview with a DSA member from, and DSA is Democratic Socialists of America, from Central Connecticut, who is kind of done a lot of work organizing and activist work in order to stave off the eviction crisis, in particular how it will potentially affect people in Central Connecticut. So stick around for that interview. But first off, I think we really have to celebrate the big win out of Buffalo, New York. I think when everyone's eyes were on New York City, India Walton just crushed the incumbent in Buffalo, and she is an avowed socialist. She's had a number of quotes that have struck me and made me feel very hopeful, namely calling out the fact that workers are the ones who do all the work, and therefore they are just taking back what is rightfully theirs. What are your thoughts been on that win, C-Money?
I think it's great for the socialist cause. You know, I saw an interview with her, and the newscaster asked her, like, you know, do you identify as a socialist? And, like, without skipping a beat, she was like, yes, absolutely, which I thought was a great thing to see. That's kind of a lot of progress right there. But, you know, a young black woman who was a high school dropout becoming a mayor of the second biggest city in New York, and, like, it's just kind of unheard of even a few years ago. And, you know, it's been, I think 1960 was the last year there was like an out and out socialist elected mayor in the United States. And that guy resigned from office for being a socialist. So,
right. That was Milwaukee, I believe. Mm. I'm hoping to actually do my graduate thesis on socialists in America and kind of what that progression has looked like. I probably have to find a narrower focus for that. But I just want to read this quote from India Walton first, just so we can kind of let this sink in as socialists. Yeah. She said, "All that we're doing in this moment is claiming what is rightfully ours. We are the workers. We do the work. And we deserve a government that works with and for us." I mean, that's a powerful statement right there.
Yeah, and, you know, after, like, some of the scenes coming out of Buffalo during the George Floyd protests with the police violence there, you know, the super racist history of the Kodak company there, this is just, it's a lot of vindication on a lot of fronts for a lot of people there. I'm really happy for everyone in Buffalo.
I would agree with that. I think it's fantastic. Now, so Dan Pecora is going to talk later on this episode with me about the work he's done in forming tenant unions. And I think a number of people, I think a fair number of Americans don't quite understand what a tenant union is. And I asked him a number of questions that kind of help flesh out the difference between a trade union, a teacher's union, for instance, and a tenant union. But C-Money, you have, I think, watched as I think Portland DSA now, I think it's called Southern Maine Maine DSA, has done a lot of this work. What have been some of the results of the organizing work that DSA has done with tenant groups in Portland and the surrounding area?
Last year, after the quarantine and during the George Floyd protests, when a lot of change just came right on the plate, Portland did form a number of individual tenant unions towards, like, certain developers, certain management companies or certain properties or the local DSA through People First Portland, former Mayor Ethan Strimling's organization that we talked about with him, organized the Portland Tenants Union, which kind of organized the organizers into one big group behind the big referendum that we had to get rent control in Portland.
Wow. So with that power of the tenants being organized and then those unions being kind of put together, they were able to win rent control. And that was done through a ballot measure. But you don't think that would have happened without the organizing of tenants?
I mean, it might have happened in individual developments or individual buildings, but at different rates, different scales for different people. By getting all the groups together, we got it across the city, which I don't think would have happened otherwise without DSA kind of helping out there.
Right. And I think one of the other things that came to light from the conversation with Dan Pecora, not our brave co-host, Dan, who is lost in the wilderness currently, is that evictions are happening already. You know, the CDC moratorium left a lot of loopholes. And also Dan Pecora brings up the fact that there are a number of renters who don't understand their rights. And so when they get that notice to quit or they, you know, get summoned to court, they don't always, you know, reach out or reach out for support and fight back. Right. And I just want to kind of share the scale of this on the national level. The Center on Budget and Policy Priorities estimates that 11 million Americans are currently behind on their rent, and that's 15% of the total adult renter population, right? So if we don't have interventions, if we don't have tenant unions standing up and fighting back, this could be a massive crisis of homelessness. And we did see recently Governor Newsom, you know, under fire from the far right. He stood up and I think took the lead on this and announced that the enormous, you know, budget that California has, you know, they set aside a large amount of money for COVID and, you know, for COVID mitigation, but then for kind of rebuilding after COVID, they're going to pay off a lot of the rental arrears and basically guarantee that the homelessness crisis that already exists, you know, the unhoused population in some of those cities, as we talked about with Hubbard in the last episode, Lauren Hubbard, who's running for California 22 U.S. Congress district, is, you know, is already enormous. So I think Governor Newsom took a bold step. He did the right thing, though. You know, I don't think in good conscience any leader can just stand by and watch this crisis play out.
Well, yeah, with the way the homelessness crisis is in California already at a fever pitch, like adding that many more people to it would make it. I mean, it's already a crisis, but it would be a compounded crisis at that point. I mean, when you're sitting on that much undispersed COVID fundage, like what better way to use it? You know, the only thing that gets me about it is that he's paying the landlords who got like the stimulus that everybody else got.
Yeah, I actually brought this up with Dan Pecora, and the fact that my sympathies do not lie with the landlords on this. But I do think politically it's going to be really tough to get anything done that leaves landlords in the lurch. Right. And so I think, you know, you and I know that there are a lot of large rental groups out there, you know, that rent to thousands of families at a time. But you'll hear it mentioned whenever this is brought up that it's the mom and pop landlords that are going to get hurt. And, you know, there's some truth to that. But my sympathies lie with families who would otherwise be unhoused or individuals who are going to be on the street or in shelter, you know, with still, we have not reached herd immunity in the country. So I do hope that other states follow the lead of California here and really step up to the plate and use whatever funds are available. You mentioned that California's funds were undispersed. You know, I do think there's a large amount of money flowing to states through the rescue package. And I think that there is some discretion left to governors to make this choice. So I hope that we see that going forward. But I'm really excited about this interview. So let's go ahead and listen to what Dan Pecora has to say. Now, listeners, I am going to leave the listener survey up for another couple of weeks. I want to get as much feedback from you as possible. So it's just a quick 5-question survey. And it's just going to help us kind of shape the show to kind of meet what it is that you tune in for. So if it's the interviews you like, or if whatever it is that you love about the show, let us know in that survey, and we'll help. That'll help us make the show into kind of what it is that you tune in for. Guest on this episode is Central Connecticut DSA member and tenant rights activist Dan Pecora. Dan also runs a podcast called the Snowflake Sports Podcast. Welcome to Trickle Down Socialism, Dan. It's great to have you on the show.
Yeah, great to be here. I love the name too, Trickle Down Socialism. Like, it's very, very easy, you know, like 3-little synonym kind of thing, like a TDS. So, well done.
Yeah, I really wanted to turn Reaganomics on its head there. So I understand that after a whole lot of organizing, you and your fellow DSA members have gotten a right to counsel included in a Connecticut version of the rescue bill. First off, could you just explain to our listeners what right to counsel is and why it matters for tenants?
Yeah, so basically in a nutshell, right to counsel for eviction is a guaranteed no-cost legal representation to tenants in eviction cases and ensures tenants are notified of their rights. So basically evictions are civil cases, so there's no public defender given to someone facing an eviction since public defenders are only used for criminal cases. And then statistics show that like fewer than 7% of tenants have legal representation in evictions compared to more than 80% of landlords. So there's already like a complete power struggle, like right from the beginning between the landlord and tenant. And it makes sense because like tenants, if they're behind on rent, they probably don't have money for a lawyer or just like to retain that. And then, so we've had, there's some Central Connecticut DSA members who are also like Connecticut Fair Housing Center lawyers, and they came up with like the budgetary stuff, and they like this is like rent right to counsel isn't like a fully new thing. There's I think Washington State was the first state to pass it, then Maryland had it, then now Connecticut, and then there's multiple cities like Cleveland's had it, I think New York passed it like I think 2017, somewhere around there. But so like in Connecticut alone, it would save the state between 2 and 12 times their investment, just because you don't have to pay for homelessness shelters and all these other necessary programs to shelter them. And then right to counsel, like just important for tenants, just because like it really just levels the playing field when facing an eviction. So most of the time, and this is even more true throughout the pandemic, someone in their household loses their job, and since they're living paycheck to paycheck, just trying to get by, they start to fall behind on their payments, and then eventually they get the notice to quit, to leave the premises. So a lot of tenants are also living paycheck to paycheck, and that could easily be a situation that you just run into, and rent is, you know, through the roof in every metropolitan city in America. So it, like, this is just very important to have this basic fundamental right.
Sure, that's a great explanation. And there could be a number of reasons why tenants just kind of take that notice as kind of gospel, right? Where you could have someone who is undocumented, you could have someone who just doesn't know what their rights are in that situation. Is that something that you've encountered?
Yeah. So a lot of times what happens is when they get the notice to quit, they ignore it, and they think that if I ignore it, that it'll actually delay the process. But in actuality, it actually speeds it up because they're like, oh, you didn't come to this court date, you didn't answer the notice, so like the judge is just gonna file like for the landlord. And it's a struggle sometimes, because when you actually like if you, we've been trying to like door knock for those evictions and just, but there's like so many of them that we don't have like the manpower to do it. And then if, even if they are able to go to the court and be like, oh yeah, like this is notice to quit. Most of the time it's like they get a 30-day extension, which is like, it's like kind of a win, but like not really, you know, because they still have to leave the, their home. So it's just a weird kind of thing.
Yeah, I, as a housing advocate in Framingham, I remember that, like, the panic in clients' faces when they got that notice or when they knew they had 30 days and they, you know, would come to us and say, what am I going to do in 30 days? You know, it's just, right. If you go out and get a second job, that's not even going to pay in time to help you out with that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So could you share with our listeners, you know, you mentioned the cost savings, right? And I think that's because of the all of the effects of poverty and homelessness on a family or an individual. But what is the scope of the problem that you're looking at, maybe Connecticut-wide or even particular city in central Connecticut? You know, how many people could be saved by a program that prevents eviction, or, you know, how many people would end up without a home if nothing is done, you know, if evictions take place as slated?
Gotcha. Yeah. So I apologize for the dated statistic because we've been pushing this for about, well, I guess not a year, almost like 6 months, which is kind of short in pushing a bill through any municipality. But basically, so it was based off a report by the National Council of State Housing Agencies on September 25th, 2020. So about 100,000 to 160 CT renter households would possibly be unable to pay rent and would be at risk for an eviction. So that's, I mean, Connecticut is 3.5 million. So that's, you know, that's a significant chunk of people. And then one of the things, biggest problems in Connecticut too, is we had a moratorium on eviction since the pandemic started. But in September 2020, the governor, Ned Lamont, rolled back a bunch of restrictions. And one of the most egregious ones that he did roll back from was if people did not pay 6 months in rent, that would be, you would be able to evict them. But like, so like March 2020 to September 2020, if you lost your job, like, and you're living paycheck to paycheck, like you're probably not going to be able to pay that rent for that 6 months. Like you're probably just trying to pay food. And you think that a moratorium is going to help you, so you don't pay that anyways. And then people just get slapped with an eviction, and evictions went like through the roof between those months. I think in February, there's a stat coming out of the Connecticut Fair Housing Center where there were 599 eviction cases in February alone in 2021. Wow. So it's awful. But
yeah, and one of the things that you mentioned there reminded me of a misconception that people have, which is like, if you lose your job, I think a lot of people think you just go on unemployment, but it unemployment is a actually pretty narrow in who gets to receive it. You know, there are so many things that have to be met in order for you to receive unemployment. And also there are so many people just like flatly, you know, excluded from that list as well.
Yeah, exactly. Which is just another hole throughout our system. So,
okay. So you've been working with Central Connecticut DSA, also, you know, in addition to this push for a right to counsel, to form tenant unions. And I'd love for our listeners to have a stronger understanding of what a tenant union is and what that union can then do if they're strong. Could you explain like why they matter and if you have any specific examples of a, you know, particular building that you know of your group organizing in and some of the results of that organizing?
Yeah. So basically, I mean, tenant unions are fairly similar to labor unions. There's just not as much like defined laws between that, but it's basically like an organized group of people who are living in, say, and we've been more focusing on just single units, but like New York City has a vast tenant union across, like they have like the, I think they have like specific ones in Brooklyn where it's like we're going to go to a landlord and pick all these properties that this mega landlord has. And like, that is your own tenant union. And then within that, like, or within that coalition, then there's tenant unions for each building specifically so that they can meet and organize as well. But yeah, so basically like if you have a problem with your apartment, if there's a rat problem, your heating isn't working, or your fridge is broken, whatever it might be, So when you have like a tenant union is formed with those tenants, you can collectively go to your landlord and tell them that like there's a problem. And it's just much more effective to do that as a group rather than as an individual. And that's the link between labor and tenant unions as well, where it's like if you're just a single person just complaining about working 12 hours a day, not getting paid overtime, like that doesn't work as well as a group doing that. So here in Connecticut, at least to my knowledge, and like the Central Connecticut DSA, and just the there's Western Connecticut, and then Quiet Corner, which is like the northeast part. We have 3 tenant unions formed, and they were all like this year. Two that are kind of linked together. There's the Millbrook Village Tenant Union and the Fitch Court Tenant Union in Windsor, which is just north of Hartford. And these 2 tenant unions came together since they are owned by the Windsor Housing Authority, and they're focused on low-income elderly people. And they're run by the same terrible executive director. We always kind of make fun of her because she's like basically like a Looney Tunes character, like evil kind of person. Like it's just like it does not make sense like how terrible she
like
is.
Montgomery Burns or Scrooge McDuck type deal. Yeah,
exactly. And then. So the third one, and I don't know the exact name of it, but it had to do with like Gerrard Street in Hartford. And one of our DSA members led the charge on that one. I guess to focus back on the Millbrook Village and the Fitch Court Union. So they actually, the way we actually got in contact with them was through the Right to Counsel. We had a public hearing. And people would talk about how important right to counsel was for them and how like it'll help protect tenants. And we actually got in contact with someone who lived in Windsor who like knew all these awful things that happened to it. And then we got connected through her, like through another DSA member. And then we were just like, hey, well, you could do a tenant union. And then like that like linked together. So that worked out well. And we actually heard that those not we, but like that tenant union got the executive director fired, I think a couple months ago, just because there was a lot of pressure on like that director and how she was treating them. And the local newspaper, the Hartford Courant, wrote a story about their living situations, which included trash being left in the hallway, and they weren't allowed to use community gatherings. And this was even before the pandemic; it wasn't like a kind of health concern. And then
it
for
was
the
just Gerard, flat racism, right?
Like the, yeah. and then the Gerard Tenant Union, they weren't getting their mail, which is straight up like a federal crime.
Yeah.
So then they formed that tenant union, put similar pressure on the landlord. I don't think it was in the Quran. It was some other, paper. But then they at least were able to get their mail back. But from our experience, so all these tenant unions were formed like this year, maybe late last year. I think the Gerard one might have been late last year, but it's still like kind of new, and like tenant unions are kind of hard because there's not as defined like laws defending it. Like, or for like labor unions, there actually is like laws and things that could protect you, but like with tenant unions, it's weird and it's kind of vague. But like, there's obvious like wins here already. Getting the executive director fired, getting your mail back. So it's like little things right there that it keep it promising.
So. Yeah. And I think that going forward, you know, you can stave off rent hikes and stuff like that. So one question on the mechanism behind a tenant union that came up as you were explaining, I think you did a fantastic job explaining what a tenant union is. But you know, with my labor union, I'm a teacher in Boston and I pay dues just auto deducted from my paycheck to the union. Is there any structure that helps pay for the organizing that happens, or is that something that DSA is doing kind of pro bono?
Yeah, it's pretty much pro bono. And especially so with the Millbrook Village and the Fish Court, we don't really want to like ask them for money or like our own members to like pitch in money. But we did. So we did have a Memorial Day like cookout, and that was more just like a kind of event to be like, hey, you can like gather, like screw this person, like let's just, you know, gather in this random park kind of thing. And that went great. And people were just kind of, you know, socializing, just having like a good time. But Yeah, so they don't. All right, sorry, I forget what the question was.
Yeah, it was how do they pay? What's the plan to pay for a tenant union going forward? You know, you don't have everybody receiving a paycheck from the same, like in the case of Boston teachers, we're all getting our paychecks from City of Boston. So it's super easy just to have the union tack on that, whatever the deduction is, you know. Is there a plan for a way to pay for organizing? Because I imagine that 5 years down the line, it's going to be a lot harder to keep those unions strong without some type of organizing that's paid for.
Right. Yeah, so we don't really have a system in place. And honestly, I don't even think we've kind of talked about it. But that definitely is going to be a problem in the future if we want to continue to attract more people, attract other more like tenant unions. But yeah, logistically, we haven't really thought through that process.
No, I think it's definitely survival mode right now. You know,
yeah.
My local DSA group is also running these types of drives, and it's just about trying to keep as many people housed as possible, you know, against the rising tide of capitalism, especially when property prices are so sky high. I mean, especially Metro West Boston, you know, I'm sure evictions are quite lucrative if they can get them done quickly for those property owners. One thing that I've been frustrated to see is that most of the work being done, and this might be my perception of it, but that most of the work being done to stave off mass evictions has been spearheaded by DSA groups and other groups that have risen up to meet the need. But it does not feel like this is coming from centrist Democrats, right? The Democratic Party has not stood up to strongly oppose any evictions. I heard some talk about it last summer from Democrats, but it hasn't been something that feels like it's a central focus. What's your experience with this? Do you think that my observation meets the way you've seen it, or why do you think this might be?
Yeah, no, I completely agree with you that most of the work to stave off mass evictions is led by DSA and specifically here, like Central Connecticut DSA. Though we've gotten like a lot of coalition signatures for our right to counsel petition, like the AFL-CIO, like Black Lives Matter 860, Witness to Hunger, which is a local group in New Haven, just focused on hunger issues and all that stuff. So there's a lot of like coalitions that were coming in and just like helping us out. But yeah, so to answer your question more on like how the Democrats don't seem to care about it, what we ran into was a lot of Democratic officials, even at the local level of Connecticut, like were landlords. Like they were like, so like Brandon McGee, who leads the housing committee in the local state house, is also a landlord. Now, granted, I just want to give Brandon props because he's been very receptive of right to counsel. And if it wasn't him like helping it get through the committee and do all this stuff, like it would have gone nowhere. But it's just like there's Minnie Gonzalez, who's another congresswoman in Connecticut that's like in Hartford. She's also a landlord. Like it's just like all these people are like own property. So it's like why there's no incentive for them to help tenants and like a lot of people that there's almost like no tenant representation in politics. Like it's all people who like own their own home or like have, you know, they're a lawyer or something. So they like have the money to buy said home. So it's that tenant representation isn't really there, especially in central Democrats and just like in a broader kind of sense of view. So like Democrats can't really like solve the problem of like healthcare is a human right. So like how can you even ask the question where like housing is a human right when you can't even have like basic healthcare for their own community?
That's a great way to frame it. I do wonder which of those would you actually put first, you know, if you're looking at Maslow's hierarchy of needs. But, you know, you're right. If you don't have a party that's taking a strong stand to make sure that we're cutting out the middleman and actually providing the best healthcare we possibly can, maybe they're not going to ask the same question about housing. That's really well phrased. So I've heard a lot of concern from the right and from centrist Democrats, as you just said, who many of them are property owners themselves or represent a number of property owners who donate heavily to their campaigns. But the effect that, you know, the moratoriums that we've seen state by state and the federal moratorium on, you know, evictions, there's a lot of concern I've heard in media and elsewhere about landlords and what they're going to do if we have a, you know, let's say some type of rent forgiveness program. Now, I just saw news that California has gone ahead and decided to use, you know, some money they have had set aside for pandemic relief to pay off the outstanding rent, which I think is a huge step. And if California takes the lead on that, we might see other states follow. But is this something that you know, you're thinking about? What do you think the ideal program would be to keep people housed, but also make sure that we're not causing, you know, a giant chasm in the economy for those property owners who would potentially miss out on quite a bit of money if the forgiveness doesn't come with some type of payment?
Right. Yeah. So what's kind of wild about this whole situation was, like, there was money allocated to, like, help the landlords. And this was, I think, in the first, I forget exactly the name, but for the pandemic, like the $2 trillion one. And like the landlords refused to take it, at least locally here. And so there was a government agency called the TRAP, and that was local to Connecticut, or the Temporary Rental Assistance Program. And that would give money to landlords to be able to pay, like, for that lost rent. And granted, there are a lot of bureaucratic issues just setting up the program and just being able to, like, apply to it. So money wasn't as easy to access. But still, like, small, medium-sized, or large landlords just didn't want to take the money. They would rather kick out people of their own living quarters than have government assistance, which is just mind-boggling to me. I feel like it's such an ethically, like, problem with, like, landlords and just the concept of someone in a commodified housing, like, community where they could just profiteer off, like, people making this. But you could also,
so when I was a housing advocate, what I was told is the reason they like to do that is because on the turnover they can jack up rent quite a bit. So in that interim they can make a couple quick modifications to the apartment and then really raise rents. I interrupted you there, keep going.
Oh, no worries. So they'd rather kick them out. I mean, I know you're probably just not really sympathetic to landlords, but, like, rental income has pretty much doubled in the past 2 years. So it used to be or 10 years, it used to be $400 billion in 2010. Now it's, like, roughly $800 billion in 2020. So, like, whatever money they lost, they probably have enough in the bank or something to recoup it, you know? So just get a real job. I don't know.
Maybe work for a living. How about
that? Yeah.
Good. I like that answer. I do think that this move from California could be enormous. And it could, you know, I think anytime a program like this actually works, it starts to change people's perception of government, right? And that's just kind of like what we've been trying to claw back since Reagan, and his words of, like, you know, I'm from the government and I'm here to help are the worst words in the English language. So what's next? I'd imagine that you're not feeling done. It sounds like you're describing a number of evictions happening in real time, which is just, you know, frightening. What do you have as goals for your group? And, you know, what do you hope to accomplish to protect workers and renters in central Connecticut?
Yeah, so we're primarily focused on building up tenant unions, and that focus has been around the cities in, like, central Connecticut, namely Hartford, New Haven, and Bridgeport. And since, like, the vaccines have been rolling out, people are much more comfortable, like, canvassing and going door to door. So that's been a lot more promising. We're actually, like, talking to people face to face. It's not just, like, on Zoom. It's very limited to, like, who we know and, like, who has internet access to get there, because sometimes, like,
you're talking to a teacher of public school students about the limitations of Zoom. You don't even explain that.
Yeah, you understand. You got it. So we've been focusing more on, like, there's a Pike management in New Haven. So we've been trying to go door to door to them, because they just own, like, a ton of properties. And it's been, like, recent. It's been, like, the last, like, 2 or 3 years. They just, like, bought property after property. And then, so we've done also teach-ins on, in the past, about decommodified housing, on tenant unions. Actually, someone from the Boston DSA came and did a teach-in on the on tenant unions, and she was great. And she'd like had like this whole like thermometer of like, because like with tenant unions, it's like great. Like we signed this thing, we have these lists of demands. Like now what? Because it's like not the landlord's not just going to automatically hand that over. So right. It's like, but like the steps you could do, you know, is kind of you can go to the landlord and like picket their house out there, maybe hand out flyers to their neighbors, being like, hey, this landlord is doing terrible things. Like you should know about that. To like the ultimate, like a rent strike kind of thing where no one pays their rent and like it just kind of builds the community together, I guess, and to fight those like increasing rents or just
The solidarity that comes out of a rent strike. The Black Panther Party did it in a number of cities where they were because of rat infestation or any number of problems, and they organized some really successful rent strikes. I actually just taught my students about it, and the kids, you know, really started cheering with the crowd. The solidarity is infectious in those types of situations.
Oh, that's so awesome. That's good to hear, like, the youth getting actually educated on that stuff, too. Like, it's fantastic. Trying to get, basically, our main focus is, like, tenant unions and trying to build power through organizing. So we believe that once these groups are organized for tenant rights, that we will be able to shift them more to other kind of leftist issues, like such as climate change, healthcare, like increased public transit, you know, increased minimum wage, kind of that stuff, if they want to. And all of these, like all of these organizations, they're going to have to be run by like non-DSA members. Like it's going to have to be run by people who live in these units.
Absolutely.
So like the focus of them is going to shift and change, but it's like that's the whole thing of organizing, is you're organizing other people to organize. Mm-hmm. Like that's how you win. So
yeah, that's cool. And who do you target with the teach-ins? Like you mentioned Boston DSA coming to your DSA, do you go out to other groups and try to teach these methods and motivations and stuff?
Before that teach-in, we tried canvassing. There's a group called Avalon Village in like Hartford specific area, and they like are terrible. Like if you just Google them, like on Google Maps and go Avalon Village, you can see all these reviews where it's like all these like rat infestations, all these terrible kind of tenant issues. We tried canvassing a couple times, but it's hard to get into these buildings sometimes because you need to either know someone or get like buzzed in kind of thing. But we did talk to like some people there. I don't think they really showed up, but I think it was more almost internal to other DSA members to try to get them to go out and organize like their own kind of building.
So did you go into some buildings with, have you done this personally, like gone into buildings and started to talk to residents about forming a tenant union?
Yeah.
What's that rush like, that, you know, the being so super nervous about like going into someone else's building and talking to strangers? Is that?
Yeah. It's a little shocking too. And it's just kind of some, like, especially when I was first doing it, it's very like, you get nervous, you kind of just say the thing in the minute, and then they're like, okay, cool. You hand them like a pamphlet and then you like run away. But sometimes you kind of like have a conversation and be like, hey, how's it going? Most of the canvases that I've been doing specifically has been like eviction outreach, just being like, hey, like you have an eviction impeding, here's the resources that you can have to help you. It's just the way that the conversation flows is just like you kind of give the little spiel and then be like, hey, how's it going? Like trying to actually like build that relationship. It's weird because like sometimes people don't want to talk to you a lot. If anyone does canvassing, like a lot of people just don't answer too because they're either not home or like who's answering the door.
In the days of cell phones, it's like very weird to have someone unannounced at your door.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's been effective when we get people there, or if we actually like talk to people. But it's just getting that initial contact is pretty difficult.
I can imagine. That's really cool. So both my parents grew up in Connecticut. My mom in Waterbury, and my dad in Simsbury. one thing that's always shocked me whenever I read up about it or talk to family who still live there is the enormous disparity between the way that people live in cities and the way that people live in the country in the suburbs, in Connecticut specifically. So like you mentioned New Haven, but Waterbury's on that list too. You know, just the average household income is just so much lower than in the suburbs. And I believe I read at some point it was the biggest disparity in the country. What can be done about that? Like, how can that problem, I know being fixing it is a huge undertaking, but at least addressing it and you know, diminishing that disparity, what do you think needs to be done?
Yeah, so I think, so it's kind of wild though that your parents grew up in both Waterbury and Simsbury, because that's like the perfect representation of like the income disparity. So yeah. Quick research on like medium households. So Waterbury's median household was 42 grand, while Simsbury now is almost like 120 grand. So that's like three times. And that's median, right? Like, that's like the average person brings home 120 grand, which is ludicrous. this is like an internal struggle within Central Connecticut DSA, or like at least with myself, I'd say. Because like what I believe that would help fix this is if you change the zoning laws in Connecticut suburbs to create multifamily housing units. And some of these towns and suburbs do not allow it based on like the character of their town, which AKA is racist. And basically saying like, hey, these colored people can't come here. So we're just going to have these huge like giant mansions and it'll be fine.
New form of redlining is what it is.
Yeah.
It's like making sure that some areas stay white. Stay rich, but yeah.
Yeah. And it's kind of weird too, because like Fairfield County, which is down close to New York City, like it's much more apparent there. But like even in Fairfield County, there's Bridgeport, which is like has more of the lower income, more people of color that live there. So that's kind of how I would tackle it, was like go to the suburbs, especially like suburbs that touch the actual. So like I live in Hartford, so like, you know, try to get West Hartford, try to get Weathersfield, East Hartford is actually pretty good about multifamily housing, but like the ones that are at least close to the cities, and then the rural ones maybe get to them, but I just feel like you can't really change those laws. Some DSA members believe that like gentrification of Connecticut cities needs to be stopped before you move to the suburbs. So it's like, okay, let's get into these cities, let's move it more left, let's try to get like actual social housing. Like Section 8 is great for what it is, but it could be so much better. Like if we tried, like, and this is just like kind of the dream of like trying to be like Vienna and Austria and just having like very nice apartments right in downtown. You got like your groceries, like these 20-minute like walkable neighborhoods where you can get everything you need all right there.
And it's much more environmentally sustainable too to have that type of living.
Exactly. So it's just that focus alone, because right, like gentrification I feel like is a problem in Connecticut, not as much as like Boston or New York or bigger cities, so I totally understand that. I just think that like there's just more suburbs and you can like just like bulldoze like one of these huge mansions and just build housing there. But like there is so like there's a town in Woodbridge which is borders New Haven, and they're thinking about adding like a 4-unit like condo kind of thing, and there's just like uproar in that city or in that town as well. So it's an uphill climb to say.
Sure. I mean, the other piece of that is if you start to move people to the suburbs, you have to think about transportation in a more sustainable way than roads. But yeah,
right.
Exactly. Cool. Well, you know, I do want to give you a minute here to plug your podcast. You described it a little bit before we started recording, and it sounds like it's super cool and some of our listeners might want to check it out. So can you tell us about Snowflake Sports?
Yeah, for sure. Snowflake Sports Podcast is a podcast started about 2 years ago now. And basically, so it focuses on the NBA and the NFL. And we talk about like, you know, what the playoffs are happening, you know, what LeBron James is doing, all those like major kind of things. And so I am from Rochester, New York. So my teams are the Buffalo Bills and the Toronto Raptors. So the snowflake is kind of because like where I'm from is cold. And then also, so at the end, we try to cover some news that's happening in the world or like the country or states they'll go to Connecticut, states they'll go to Rochester. So we try to kind of intertwine those two, like sports and politics, because that is typically broken in most, and no, in all sports outlets. So trying to mix those two together. So.
Yeah, I mean, the activism we've seen out of NFL, I teach at least a week about Kaepernick every year to my students, because it's a civics course, and it's like, here's what, you know, direct action looks like. But, you know, so much activism. You mentioned LeBron James. He's like single-handedly fixing schools for a huge number of kids by building that. Like, that's like the school that Marianne Williamson imagines when she describes what schools should be in the United States, you know?
Yeah.
No, she's not wrong on so many things, actually. She's actually very left and has been doing this for a long time. She has some great ideas. They're just sometimes all the dots aren't connected on how we get there.
Yeah, exactly.
But that's great. I love that you're making sure that some sports fans have a place to listen to sports talk and some of the political stuff that is missed. As you said, you know, ESPN, if they wanted to talk about the activism behind so many athletes, you know, I think they could have some really cool stuff going on with that.
Oh yeah, definitely. And then Jaylen Brown in Boston too is a huge like activist, and like drove, I think, like 13 hours when all the George Floyd protests were happening. So
Yeah, super cool. Well, Dan, I really appreciate you taking time out of your Monday night to chat with me here. And I'd love to keep in touch and kind of compare notes on what DSA is doing in different regions of New England, and potentially have you back on the show if there's something else you get into with DSA that you want to report on.
Yeah, for sure. No, thanks for having me on. It's been a pleasure.